Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them.
Disrespect sits in the studio today with Michelle Hrushka. She sits on the Food Security Committee of the Campaign for Adequate Welfare and Disability Benefits. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me here, Jeff.
Okay. What caught my eye was that the spec documented that you appeared before a session of City Council where they sat as the Board of Health, the same guys wearing different hats, and put them on the spot, however politely, about the way things are for people's food security in Hamilton.
Yes, I did.
You raised some issues about food quality and involvement with food quality and dignity in regard to food.
Yes. Many of our members of the campaign, they come in with stories all the time about the quality of food, the service. For many members of the campaign, they have disabilities, so there's only actually one food bank in Hamilton that it's accessible. For those who have disabilities, the rest are non-accessible. So
which is the accessible one?
The Salvation Army.
Where is that? York?
York Boulevard, yes.
Okay.
Because they can go in there.
Okay, good.
Yeah. But the rest of them are not accessible. So we've heard stories where, you know, people have to, you know, leave their scooters outside and somebody's taken them.
No.
So it's not a good situation where, you know, people are standing outside for hours.
Yeah.
Many of the people, you know, they have illness. So you're standing outside, whether it's rain or snow, hot, for hours.
And then when you get back outside, there's no scooter for you to go home.
Right.
Or take your groceries or anything.
Well, it makes it hard because whatever they give you, you have to take that. And many of them find that they're not even able really to carry the amount.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? So they have to struggle to get it down the stairs.
Yeah.
On their scooters and then
get it home. These scooters are worth $2,000 to $4,000, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not a good situation.
Right. What kind of incomes are these people facing who go to the food banks?
It varies.
Single moms?
There'd be single mothers, people on OW. Mm-hmm. What we're noticing is for those people who are on ODSP, they're seemingly going through a lot of means testing right now. Mm-hmm. So trying to disqualify them from ODSP.
Okay.
You know, trying to, because they're creating divisions, like, you know what I mean? So if someone has who is on ODSP, I think a lot of people have a misconception as to about how much money they actually get. For a single person on Ontario Works, you're entitled to $572 a month.
Right.
So even with trying to find shelter, because with affordable housing flagship and mm-hmm. other groups in the city, that for one bedroom, it's like $650. That's about the average. So they're not even getting that for shelter.
What is affordable housing flagship?
It's a group within the city working on trying to get affordable housing issues to the mainstream.
So it's a systemic issue group?
Yes.
Okay. Not
you know, you know what I mean?
Not a casework group.
No.
All right.
No.
Okay. So we have people ranging from $572 a month up to probably somewhere in the middle teens if they've got a few kids. And their rent problem would probably be very similar. You probably end up paying, what, $800 and change for a multi-bedroom apartment.
Yep.
Yeah.
At least that.
In Hamilton. Yeah. Yeah, and then you've got to feed and clothe and move your family around. So when they get to the food bank, it's not accessible. The waiting outside to get a position at the bank so that the bank isn't full up when you get to the head of the line can be a concern. And if it's not accessible, then that limits the number of food banks that you can go to, and each one is only 1 month or once a month or once every 2 months.
Some are once every 6 months that you can go, some are once a month, some are other stipulations. There's no uniformity within the food banks. Mm-hmm. They're pretty well left to set their own kind of policies. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem in itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
there's a certain issue of dignity in waiting in line for the food bank out in public too, I think, for somebody who's newly unemployed. I mean, you might say too bad, but I mean, it's a long jump to admit that you can't feed yourself because you've lost your job.
I know when I spoke in front of the committee, one of the counselors made a remark, and I kind of spoke up that, you know, if you're a worker who's lost their job due to the economy,
mm-hmm.
You may have rent or mortgage, your bills like utilities and mm-hmm. loans, you could have car insurance.
Yeah, you don't lose those with your job.
No, you don't. So you may not be accessible to EI benefits because we've seen a lot of workers who have been denied EI. And then you're left with Ontario Works. And for a single person, you're only entitled to $572.
Mm-hmm.
So you could lose your home, you could lose your vehicle, you could lose everything
mm-hmm.
that you have
mm-hmm.
in a relatively very short time.
Sitting at home alone with no TV and no phone, right?
You know, so I fail to understand how the system thinks that it's really helping people, because it's not. You're just putting more stress onto already stressed out people, and it's a failure all the way around from all three levels of government. That's the way I see it.
Yeah, well, it's a peculiar issue for me that a system into which you pay all your life, when it comes time that you need it, makes a big point that they're doing you a favor, and that favor may not feed you and may not shelter you, but you'd better be quiet about the shortcomings of it.
Yeah, well, they don't like when people speak out. But usually, I've been around with the campaign since 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And the more noise you make, the better it is, because you're bringing those issues and topics to the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
There may be a lot of people out there in the community who I know they fear when groups are trying to do something that would make it better for them in the long run, but they fear that, especially around food issues, because this is all they get. So they fear that they're not going to get anything.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a real fear out there.
So it's hard sometimes to speak out. If you're dependent for the very food you get and you're worried that you might not even get that, it's hard to speak out.
Right.
Okay.
You know, that's just the mindset of people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and some people mistakenly believe that the system is set up to give you what you need, or
no,
that the
not.
System has a regard for what you need. The system only really has a regard for its own rules, is my view. And I've been told flat out, we don't provide shoes for your orthotics just because your shoes are worn out. We provide shoes every 2 years. And I've heard other people complain about this. So what are you supposed to walk on between now and 2 years from now, you know?
No, there's a real lack of understanding, caring. I think from my own personal view,
yep.
that we've seen, you know, everything almost privatizing. So what's good for the public good or the people has kind of gone by the wayside. So you're seeing many people out there struggling, whether they're the disabled or sick or have just lost their jobs, and just trying to maintain what they have or had, and many fall through the cracks, and they wonder why, you know, homelessness, crime, all different other kind of social ills come to the forefront, because some people are very strong emotionally, other people, they're not so strong, and, you know, when you're, you know, trying to do everything to, you know, find a job and maintain everything, that stress level could just make you push you
mm-hmm.
to something that you really don't want, you could become...
Especially if you're getting it from all sides.
Well, yeah, you know, it's
no
it's,
food, new social position that you're not used to, yeah.
It's very...
Shelter insecurity.
It's very difficult.
Yeah.
I know that some of our members have really gone through really hard times. There was one particular member, an older person, and he finally got off OW and onto some kind of pension, but for those months and months and months, it was just a struggle, because every month he would be cut off OW, and then what shelter he had was at risk. So, you know, you're running around trying to get this and that. And
I don't think people understand. It's very expensive to be poor. It's not only expensive in terms of money, because you have to pay the spot rate for whatever transaction you're making, because you can't store something away. You don't have the money, and you can't wait till there's a sale. You just pay the rate that whoever's dealing with you dares to charge you when they find out that you're desperate.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the same thing time-wise. It's very time-consuming to be poor.
Yeah, well, it is, you know. Even for a single person who is struggling, you know, you may not have bus fare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have the $2.50 to get on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
So you're walking. Everywhere's mm-hmm. walking. So if you're...
Oh, even the bus is about five times the time it takes to drive by car in many places.
Well, yeah, and if you're searching for food, because if you live down the city, you can't use anything that's up the mountain and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the question of food quality when people run out of food, that it's not always edible.
No.
Is this more common in, I'm not going to ask you to name them, but is this more common in some food banks? Does it vary?
We did a focus group, and what we found was that some of the people go to some of the local churches,
mm-hmm.
and they found the quality of food a little bit better at the churches, wherever they're going.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have specifics as to where they're going, but to the mainstream kind of food share,
mm-hmm.
food banks, yeah, there were more complaints about the food quality.
Okay.
You know, people are getting, you know, food that it's either dented, expired, so it's actually expired past the expiry date, that it's moldy, sometimes it's rotten.
People who are vision impaired must have a hell of a time with that. They can't read the expiry dates, they can't see the mold.
No, they wouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, in some cases, like, you know, let's say you're going for, like, bread, so it's right on that kind of date.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So you may go pick up, you know, I don't know, if you get one or two loaves, and then, like, in, you know, within a day, it's all green.
Oh, yeah.
Same
it
with...
It may even be green on one side, and if you don't inspect it, or you can't inspect
it. You know, so...
You get it home, and it's inedible.
Yeah, it's pretty bad, like, you know what I mean? Because... It, from a health perspective,
for which we all pay.
Well, of course, because then you're running. You know, that's why I say, you know, if someone who struggles in poverty, and let's say they get really bad food and it makes them sick, are they actually going to check into why if it was bad food?
So I've never seen an obituary that said anybody died from poverty.
No.
You mentioned that the city has a food safe zone on their website. What is that?
It's you go into myhamilton.ca and you'll find it. It's a food safe zone, and it's a listing of every organization that would serve food.
Oh.
So restaurants, institutions.
Banks.
It's supposed to cover food banks. I went in there just before I presented. There's not really anything there.
Oh, okay.
So, like...
A blank site?
It has all the names, and it's got some columns and stuff, but there's not really any kind of data.
Okay.
So
it really doesn't identify places for safe food. The assumption is that all these places are safe.
Well, I think that they just haven't updated the database.
Okay.
Right at the moment, that was the inference I got from the
if people from get bad food from somebody who's city funded, is there a place that they can bring that to the city's attention?
Well, yeah, you should phone if you're attending a food bank and you get something that's not good. phone public health.
Okay.
Lodge a complaint. They have to go. They have to look at it. You know, that was one of the things that we advocated for, because right now at the food banks they're only inspected once a year, which clearly that's not enough. There's certain rules and regulations as to how badly the cans are dented, because the seal could be broken, mm-hmm. like, you know what I mean? So the mm-hmm. food is going bad inside. So, and, you know, if the can has no labels, mm-hmm. because we're not supposed to do that anymore.
No.
Stuff that's given out kind of like in bulk, mm-hmm. because there's no labels on it, so you don't know.
Oh, I see, like bagged or something.
Bagged or stuff. So let's say you have an illness like celiac disease, mm-hmm. where you have food allergies, mm-hmm. you don't know what it's made of, so you're actually putting your own health at risk, mm-hmm. because either you eat it or you starve, because you have no choice, mm-hmm. and this is the problem. So
the plea that you have food allergies gets an initial recognition at the food banks, but I think over the longer run it's seen as an annoyance. Who are you that you can pick and choose your food and everybody else is grateful for what they're given, is the attitude that I see.
Well, yeah.
Depends on the bank?
Pardon?
Depends on the food bank?
I think it depends on the food bank. Like, we get stories about certain things from our members and, you know, outside in the community. Mm-hmm. Things like fresh fruits and vegetables are given out very infrequently. So if you have diabetes or some sort of disease like that where, you know, you're supposed to be watching what you're eating, then you have no choice because you're getting mostly canned processed food, which is high in sugar, salt, fat.
Right.
We would just like to see something better. Like, we don't advocate for food banks. Food banks are not the answer. They aren't going to sustain the problem.
Apparently you advocated for stamps or debit cards.
Yes. That was one of the solutions that we came up with, so people could actually go into the grocery store and buy what they need. I know there's a misconception out there that a lot of people say that anyone who's, you know, struggling can't budget mm-hmm. their money, but many people have to because they got such a small amount of money mm-hmm. that they have to budget. So that's mm-hmm. a fallacy right there. That's a misconception, and I would call that a lie that you know, that's propagated out there in the news and others.
I see in your speech that you've also advocated, and I didn't see it in the article by Eric McGinnis in the spec, that you advocated for community gardens and greenhouses to grow fruit and vegetables year-round.
Yes, we did.
In Toronto, they're calling it the Green Barn. Dufferin and Davenport buried the old car barns. Yeah, the old TTC car barns. Some of them have been turned into indoor food growing operations, and we don't have anything like that in Hamilton yet, do we?
No, we don't have a...
Is there any initiative for it?
I don't know at the present time. Mm-hmm. When I spoke about it, they seemed... that it would be something to look at.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, because they're looking at costs and who would use it and so on and so forth.
But they never set these off against the costs if people don't get the proper food.
No, but the campaign looks at it this way, that if you're helping someone or empowering them, so even if they're struggling, if they have the opportunity that they can grow their own food,
mm-hmm.
then they have a choice. They can grow what they want, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. specific to their needs.
Mm-hmm.
We call for that. There's several community gardens that have been around, that are around the community.
Mm-hmm.
A greenhouse.
At least in good weather. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's for the good weather. So the greenhouses would be an extension of that in the sense that you could grow all year round. If you're looking at the future, food mm-hmm. security is a definite thing because...
Local food.
Yeah, we advocate for local food. We know that there's many in the rural areas around Hamilton, you know, they're farmers, and many of them struggle just to make ends meet,
mm-hmm.
you know, because they're competing with, you know, products are coming from
Mexico.
Across the globe. So I think that it's better that we look after our own, like, you know what I mean? So
mm-hmm.
we can go to them, a local farmer, we can go to them and we can ask them, okay, how did you grow this? What products did you use? Mm-hmm. So on. But you can't go to someone in Mexico or China and ask them what they've done.
Right.
That's you true. Have no idea. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's many in the community that have been advocating for buy local.
Okay. So I also note that you made a point that special diet funding has been slashed, that a lot of people whose doctors advocated that they be provided with special diet funding because they weren't able to eat enough to stay healthy. I think the trend started with Sandra Pupatello, the MP out of Windsor and cabinet minister now, who's out of this realm, but she started the initiative to clamp down on these people and see to it that they got as little special diet funding as possible. And this trend apparently continues. Everybody's being requalified for special diet.
Yes.
And they're being requalified by health condition. So if your health condition isn't one that's listed, or if the medical community doesn't recommend the need for certain kinds of food for your health condition, you don't get it, unless you lie.
Well, the campaign had a forum on poverty and health, and we had some health professionals come out and speak. You were there.
Mm-hmm.
And we got some good information.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the message that the health professionals were trying to bring was that the health professionals themselves need to be educated
mm-hmm.
about the situations that are going on out there.
You know, people think because there's a benefit that funding is adequate. The provision of funding equals adequate funding, and it's not the case. And it hasn't been for 15 years.
Well, like for a health professional that's, you know, gone through the motions of going through all that education and stuff, you know, they may not really understand the whole kind of social safety net and how it's failing people.
Mm-hmm.
I know the one health professional spoke about the learning experience they learned since starting to practice because their patients are affected. This particular person is a real champion in the city and truly advocates and has gotten other health professionals to teach themselves.
Oh, good. That's how it's done.
That's how it's done.
On our list of hopes for the future, we have better inspection, better reporting of shortcomings in the food chain. We have more community gardens that are extended longer throughout the season, better funding for food. Have I covered it? Is there more?
Yeah, pretty well. The one thing that we pointed out was the separation of the emergency food services and the food security.
Right.
Kind of. So
okay.
Council has divided those two things, and we at the campaign kind of see that as kind of inefficient, counterproductive, and can be confusing to the public.
Right. Such as, it's not an emergency, why are we giving them food?
I don't think it's their intention, but you could kind of see it as a classism kind of argument. Because really, within our food structure,
uh-huh.
there's only 3 days' worth of food within our food system.
Okay.
So even when we had the blackout a few years back, I mean, they finally did get everything up online, you know, in a couple of days. But what if that was a few weeks?
Like Quebec, the ice storm.
Right? So the grocery chain only has, the whole system is only on 3 days. So,
right.
you know, transportation.
Yeah.
Just
breaks
how
down
transportation breaks down, so the food isn't going to go there,
yeah.
and people are going to could actually go into a kind of a panic mode,
right?
And trying to feed their families.
Yeah.
So that affects everybody at that whatever
right.
their income level
right.
is.
And if you're living on $572 a month, the idea of storing extra food is a long-term goal.
How can you store?
You can't, yeah.
you can't even buy.
Yeah,
like
exactly,
you can't even pay for shelter. And, you know, some of the places where people have to live are so
small.
Horrible.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's just, I don't understand how people can just close their eyes and ignore
mm-hmm.
the situations. I do hope that people can kind of open their eyes, kind of see what's going on, because it could be you, you know, like how they say that saying, by the grace of God.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? So you could be a worker and you could get sick. You could get a very serious, like, cancer or something. I've seen workers where they've had benefits, but the longer the illness is, and then they try to get them off.
Right.
So you could be finding yourself in a very dire situation in a relatively short time, and it's kind of naive that you would think that it couldn't happen to you.
Yeah, or that the net out there is an adequate one, because when you find out it's inadequate, then you won't be listened to. The loudest voice is the voice of the people who are empowered, the people who are not in need, who can't be identified as self-interested and speak out.
Mm-hmm.
And you've done a campaign for adequate welfare and disability benefits have done a great job speaking out, and really glad to see you in the paper in Hamilton, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's reprinted elsewhere either.
Well, I'm sure we're very happy. I know that through the campaign, like the article has flashed around, and we've got many comments from many of the members. So they're very happy to see the exposure. It also gives us, as a group, recognition out there in the community, that because we like to see ourselves as representing the 100,000 plus that are struggling.
Mm-hmm. It's half a million in Hamilton. There are 100,000 struggling.
Yep.
Okay.
That's what they.
Official stats?
That's kind of official stats, but who knows, because there could be a lot more that are hidden out there.
Keep plugging. I got published in The Spectator on the subject of the inadequacy of social supports, and it turned up in an article published in the Carnegie Center, where they just took the word Ontario and put the word BC in brackets after it and published the whole article out there. So people do read The Spec.
Mm-hmm.
And the word does get around.
Yes. Well, the internet is a very wonderful tool. I know myself that I'll type in something, what I'm looking for, and it takes you to many, many, many different places, even YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can see lots of things on YouTube, and you can even type in Hamilton, Ontario on YouTube and get the stuff that other community members have posted, whether it's issues of housing, because I've seen one, couple videos out there about housing. And let's put it this way, I was actually quite shocked that these people actually lost in tribunal.
Depends who you get in the tribunal.
Well, given the video evidence, because the video evidence that they had and everything, mm-hmm. I was quite shocked that they actually lost. So
I'm not. I've been to the tribunal. There are some people there who are pro-client, and there's some people there who are anti-client. And as harsh as that sounds, I know it to be true. Let's hope that we're not just talking to the converted here, that we're talking to people who will come away, think about it, and want to make a difference. And, of course, it'll be posted on the web as a podcast. And I think you've made a very good case, and you've made it very publicly. Thanks for coming in, Michelle.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Okay. As we make the transition to the review of the news now, I have some cuts from a new album that I picked up at HMV this weekend. If you're in at HMV's head office, which is the only store I know where this kind of variety can be found in southwestern Ontario, say hello in the blues and classical department to Tien, who works at a community radio station that's resumed broadcasting in the last week. Hattie Brooks, from the album Blue and Boogie, Brooks Boogie.
Now it's time for the Disrespect Review of the Weekly News. We remind you that these are not the whole story. These are excerpts from the stories printed in the journals that we reveal during the broadcast. If you detect a sniffiness in this reading, it's probably me. Proposals Set to Rile Prescription Drug Industry by Tom Blackwell in the National Post, Friday, October 2nd. A new war is brewing over Canada's multi-billion-dollar prescription drug business, fueling death threats against a top government official, plans for a major lobbying campaign, and predictions of furious political debate to come. The tension stems from proposals by the Ontario government to again revamp its system for reimbursing the cost of generic drugs, perhaps by further slashing the sometimes hefty rebates paid by generic manufacturers to pharmacies and maintaining lower generic prices. Analysts predict the changes expected to be unveiled within months will likely be copied by some or all the other provinces' drug benefit programs. This may possibly lead to taxpayer savings of hundreds of millions of dollars. The pharmacy business is readying to make its voice heard. Sarah Feldman, a spokeswoman for the Canadian Association of Chain Drug Stores, confirmed that the trade group has taken on extra help from Navigator Limited and Campbell Lobby Firms and Hill & Knowlton Public Relations Consultants to help press home its position. She argued that the dispensing fees paid to pharmacies by the province fall far short of the store's actual cost for filling prescriptions, especially when many are now open 24 hours. If the province takes an axe to the professional allowances paid by manufacturers without new offsetting fees, it will seriously affect bottom lines, Ms. Feldman said. For many pharmacies, if it wasn't for the generic allowances, they would be losing money, and you can't run a business on losing money, she said. Again, the National Post. Recovery could be jobless. Flaherty by Andrew Maeda. Ottawa, Canada's economic recovery could end up missing one key element, more jobs. Unless Ottawa keeps the stimulus money flowing, Finance Minister Jim Flaherty says. In the wake of the disappointing growth numbers, Flaherty acknowledged the threat of a jobless recovery. We certainly had that discussion at the G20 summit in Pittsburgh, the danger of a jobless recovery, the finance minister said. The Conservatives have steadfastly vowed not to raise taxes, meaning the books will have to be balanced through economic growth and spending restraint. Mr. Flaherty again insisted the government would make the necessary belt-tightening decisions once the medium-term economic picture becomes clear. The government is also promising not to cut transfers to the provinces, including money for health care and social programs, as well as transfers to individuals, such as benefits for children, the elderly, and the unemployed. We're not going to touch those, Mr. Flaherty said, of provincial transfers. That's what the Liberals did during the 1990s. I lived through that as a provincial minister and what that meant to Ontario and other provinces about closing hospitals and not being able to build schools. EI rates are bound to go up. This looks like the Star. Dan Kelly, Independent Voice. Should employment insurance benefits be made more generous? Do long-term workers need special benefits? Should there be a new, much lower national qualifying period for EI benefits of 360 hours of employment? These questions are being debated in the nation's capital as EI becomes one of the most contentious political issues of the day, and they're important issues. EI is one of the top priorities for Canadian Federation of Independent Business small business members across the country. The problem is these debates over benefit levels miss the real elephant in the room. EI is going to go heavily into deficit in the coming years, even without an increase in benefits. Piling on new programs will only make a bad situation a lot worse, requiring massive EI premium rates for every employed person in Canada, and the impact on businesses and ultimately job creation could be even worse as employers pay $1.40 in EI premiums for every dollar of workers' pay. Freezing rates at 2008 levels was a smart move as the global recession was just starting to take hold. It ensured workers and employers wouldn't be saddled with higher payroll taxes when there was economic uncertainty. It seemed particularly appropriate for government to freeze rates in weaker times, given that it took a total of $57 billion out of the EI fund to pump into general revenues during good times. It appears the rate freeze only deferred the pain. Ottawa seems intent on clawing back the portion of the freeze associated with higher unemployment rates in 2009 and 2010. When EI rates are set in 2011, there will almost certainly be an immediate hike to fund this gap. Canadians could see maximum allowable increases in EI premiums for several years. And with unemployment projected to remain reasonably high after 2010, the additional difference in unemployment rates will result in an even larger shortfall in premium revenue. If Ottawa wants to engage in real stimulus with proven results, it should do the right thing and return the money that belongs to the EI fund so Canadians aren't forced to foot a huge EI bill. At a time when our economy is supposed to be getting back on track, a giant increase in EI premiums could derail us. Let's stop arguing about the increasing benefits and have a closer look at that great big elephant in the room. Hamilton Spectator, Thursday, October 1st. Ombudsman slams cap on cancer drug by Joanna Frkhetich. Ontario's ombudsman sided with Burlington cancer patients, saying Ontario's cap on a life-prolonging drug is unreasonable, wrong, and verges on cruelty. His investigation, prompted by complaints from Burlington colorectal cancer patients and Conservative MPP Joyce Saveline, concluded the Ministry of Health's decision to limit Avastin to 16 two-week treatments was arbitrary, not supported by medical evidence, and done purely for cost containment. The funding limit flies in the face of the acceptable standard of oncology practice in this province and beyond, stated Ombudsman Andre Marin in his report called Avast Injustice. Regrettably, this situation verges on cruelty for those already affected by this unrelenting illness. In the case of Avastin, it is impossible to justify the human price exacted by the current administration's inflexible and dispassionate application of the funding limit. Marin thanked Burlington patients for coming to him in April with their stories of being cut off Avastin regardless of how they were responding to the treatment. He agreed they shouldn't have to decide between paying thousands of dollars or abandoning a treatment that's working and recommended by specialists. Kaplan said he'd reconsider the funding cap on Avastin if there is new medical evidence to justify the extension, which Marin failed to produce. If he can provide any clinical evidence, of course I'd look at it, said Kaplan. The government did agree to post the considerations at play when reaching a drug funding decision. The government will also monitor the actual expense of covering Avastin, which Marin says it hadn't been doing, and it will report back to the Ombudsman on a quarterly basis so he can ensure drug funding is being made more accountable. The ministry's credibility right now is suffering, said Marin. They have to now go out of their way to be open and transparent and not mislead the public. Now another cut from the Queen of Boogie, Hadda Brooks from Blue and Boogie, Jukebox Boogie.
Globe and Mail. More flu programs suspended by Carolyn Alfonso in Toronto. Confusion grows over relationship to catching H1N1 from seasonal shots. Canada's influenza vaccination strategies are being thrown into question, with confusion growing among Canadians after a controversial study suggested people are twice as likely to contract pandemic H1N1 if they have received a seasonal flu shot. The unpublished study suggests that those under 50 years of age are at a higher risk of being infected with the swine flu virus after receiving the annual seasonal flu shot. Details of the study, coupled with skepticism in some quarters about the new H1N1 vaccine, could place territorial and provincial inoculation programs in disarray, with fewer people turning up for either shot. Lead authors Danuta Skowronski of the British Columbia Centre for Disease Control and Gaston de Serre of Laval University have submitted their findings to an unnamed scientific journal and may not comment until it is published. Their paper found that consistency across four epidemiologic studies and one animal experiment suggests an association that cannot be dismissed on the basis of chance and is unlikely to be explained entirely by bias. If this association is real, these studies together suggest that recipients of seasonal influenza vaccine were at moderate 1.5 to 2-fold increased risk of medically attended H1N1 illness during the spring-summer in 2009, the paper said. The findings have yet to be published, but word of it has prompted provinces and territories to revamp their vaccination programs. British Columbia, Prince Edward Island joined Quebec, Saskatchewan, Ontario, and Nova Scotia in suspending seasonal flu shots for anyone under 65. New Brunswick is the only province so far to say it will continue with seasonal flu shots. Ethan Rubenstein, head of adult infectious diseases at the University of Manitoba, agreed that the study complicates the situation. The only thing left to do is explain to the public exactly what this study has shown and what the consequences are. This is their duty now, and then people can decide. While other countries, including the U.S. and Australia, have not reported the same phenomenon, the study stated that it could be a result of well-established and ongoing monitoring system in Canada. This story from the Los Angeles Times via one of our Canadian dailies, Melissa Healy, parents ambivalent about swine flu vaccine. Tammy Reed is not a believer of conspiracy theories and is not rattled by the phrase pandemic flu. The Menifee, California resident is the kind of mom who gathers her medical intelligence from government websites and is raising her toddler daughter with all the confidence of a former nanny. She's the kind of mom who thinks that when the vaccine for H1N1 influenza becomes available for her daughter, she may just pass on it. It's a different brand of flu, but it's still the flu. And I think she's built a pretty strong immune system, Reed, 28, says, of her 14-month-old. I'm more concerned about the long-term effects, Reed says. For now, she's made her peace with the prospect that her daughter Coral could have a few miserable days and a lifetime immunity from this novel strain of flu. The new H1N1 virus has changed. A significant proportion of our population don't want to get it, says Los Angeles pediatrician Mikhail Abramian. I don't even know whether I will advocate for it for right now. People in their 20s, 30s, and 40s have been largely spared the yearly deliberations over flus of vaccine, either for themselves or their kids. School-aged children and their parents are mostly in robust health. The new H1N1 virus has changed all that. Epidemiologists have found that children, young adults, and pregnant women who catch the new flu run a greater risk than the elderly of developing complications. So all three groups top the list of those recommended to get H1N1 vaccine this year. Complacency is a big challenge, said Dr. Anne Shushat of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But for Reed, complacency is not the problem. The problem is a swirling debate in which opinion passes for science, and the motives of long-trusted sources, physicians, and health officials are being questioned. Spectator, September 30th, H1 Outbreaks. H1N1 Outbreaks Hit Schools by Daniel Nolan. An outbreak of H1N1 influenza has been confirmed at St. Mark Catholic Elementary School in Stony Creek. The Public Health Department announced the outbreak of the flu, otherwise known as the swine flu, at the White Deer Road School. The Health Department also confirmed an outbreak of influenza A at Columbia International College. It has not been confirmed as the H1N1 strain at the Main Street West School, but the department said that is the predominant strain circulating and more lab tests are being done. Michelle Baird, manager of infectious diseases, couldn't say how many students have the flu at the schools. Columbia, said to be the largest private university prep school in Canada, has 1,300 students from 51 countries. St. Mark's has 700 students and is one of the largest schools within the Hamilton-Wentworth Catholic District School Board. Says Baird, what has been reported in these outbreaks is fairly mild: fever, cough, sore throat, and respiratory symptoms, but certainly, if you're at risk from complications from flu, you should follow up with your doctor, Baird said. Dr. Elizabeth Richardson, Hamilton's Medical Officer of Health, noted H1N1 has been present in the community throughout the summer, so her agency did not find it surprising that we are seeing it spread in schools, as this is typical of even seasonal influenza. Study explores cancer, stress link. Globe and Mail. Don't have a date. By Carly Weeks. Can stress cause cancer or even hasten a patient's death? It's a daunting, emotionally charged question with no simple answers, but it represents a growing field of research that scientists hope could eventually lead to breakthroughs in cancer treatment. The premise driving the theory is that stress has been found to weaken the body's immune response and cause some psychological, physiological changes, such as the secretion of certain hormones that can contribute to the development of cancer. Traditionally, much of the study in this field is focused on the effects of stress on the immune system, but now attention is shifting to the relationship between stress and gene function, an area many scientists believe is the key to unraveling this mystery. Scientists have discovered that high-stress situations can cause certain genes to become activated, while others, such as those responsible for suppressing tumor growth, may be turned off, changes that could have serious implications in the development of cancer. But a major challenge is understanding how this complex genetic relationship works and what causes changes to occur. Confounding the issue is that people respond to stress in different ways and have varying thresholds for coping with difficult situations. As a result, the potential ability of stress to affect the development or progression of cancer may change person to person, making it that much more challenging to understand. Instead of framing the discussion around cause and effect, one scientist who has studied this area for years said it's more accurate to think of the relationship between stress and cancer as one of potential risks. Stress doesn't give you cancer, but it is a risk factor, like genetic differences, like environmental carcinogens, said David Spiegel, associate chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine. There are a whole bunch of risk factors. Not everybody that smokes tobacco gets lung cancer. And we wrap up with the Globe and Mail on Saturday, October 3rd. The focus section, Doug Saunders. Special section, Reckoning. He writes from London. Trevor Phillips, the Englishman of Trinidadian descent who runs Britain's official equality promoting organization, has spent the past 5 years denouncing multiculturalism as a trap. He has warned that people from different backgrounds in Britain are living parallel lives, and that an emphasis on community cohesion has led to a system where members of ethnic minorities, are kept out of top positions because they're encouraged and funded to form separate ethnic institutions. In other words, the emphasis on community has destroyed freedom. Even more interesting is that this tyranny of community view has not just turned against the old-style view of multicultural communities, but against its chosen alternative, the effort to promote a core culture of Britishness. This idea, a Britishness agenda, was aggressively promoted by Premier Gordon Brown about 2 years ago, and it received support from surprising places. Billy Bragg, the Marxist folk singer, wrote an intelligent book making the case for British patriotism, and a lot of subtle arguments were made in favor of a British culture culture made up of diversity, pluralism, and self-criticism. In practice, though, it went over poorly. Encouraging people to identify themselves as British above all else, no matter how inclusive or appealing you make that, does not feel much better than encouraging them to be Muslim, or gay, or Slavic above all else. For nationalists, extremists, or monomaniacs, such singular identities hold an appeal. For those who want to escape them, an overarching core identity is a poor refuge. 2 weeks ago, the Times Education Supplement published a national poll of teachers on the subject of educating students on Britishness. An amazing three-quarters of them said explicitly that it was a bad idea. "We shouldn't be promoting patriotism," one teacher said. "We should be promoting universal brotherhood. Schools," they realized, "are here to help us escape the confines of community." And if you identify with the community of people with disabilities, that's something for you to think about. One last quote from the article. "A monk or a nun, a woman in a burqa, a priest with a large crucifix on his chest, present an overriding singular identity to the world, demanding thereby to be treated by others chiefly, if not exclusively, in terms of it. Such people are thereby trying to dictate to others how those others should treat them," said A.C. Grayling. Contrasting this with someone who is able to be identified simultaneously as a parent, a mathematician, a Bangladeshi, a man, a feminist, a Muslim. Such people, he says, live closer to the fulfillment of human potential, something denied or compromised by imprisonment in a single overriding identity, whether or not the imprisonment was imposed or chosen. So, is that disability an identity, or is that disability or identity? That's all for this week. Disrespect will be back next week. Come back. See us again. And now a going out cut. Hatta Brooks, from Blue and Boogie, Swingin' the Boogie.
You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.